Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5, 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network, and in more than 70 countries worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on Parthia, the forgotten ancient superpower. You know, if you're earning $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep about 41% of what you create and produce. Government gets 59%. That's about $20,000 for you and about $30,000 for the government. No, I thought that's just kind of special. Now, if you think that your share isn't enough for you, then why don't you work twice as hard and produce twice as much and make $100,000 next year? Then go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes just like you did this year, and you're going to net 24%, and the government will net 76. 24% for you, 76% for the government. Now, that means that for working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you're going to net $4,000 more, all right. That's about 8% more net take-home pay than you did this year, guaranteed, of course, by Congress and the IRS. The government makes far more than your percentage. In fact, their percentage goes up from 59% to 76, while your percentage goes up from 41. It goes up from 41 to 24%. Did you get that? Your share goes up from 41% to 24%. That's why I contend that there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners and then only net 24% of it. Why don't you call today and order my free 4-hour CD package and let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information that answers many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is that we pay so much and receive so little in return. Now, to order your free general law CD package, just call me direct. It's 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Or you can go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, Parthia, the Forgotten Ancient Superpower. This is about a 1 in 100 book. I don't think you're going to find another book like it anywhere. Stephen Collins has written 4 books out of a series of 6 so far on ancient biblical history as it relates to the Israelites, you know, the 10 lost tribes of Israel. Actually, the 10 lost tribes of Israel have been well documented throughout history. It's just that we don't teach that history in our public schools. After all, it's not politically correct. It doesn't fit with evolutionary philosophy, number one, and it doesn't fit with the New World Order or international geopolitics. Since it's not politically correct, I thought that it was something that you probably ought to know about. You can get a copy of Collins' book from Bible Blessings, Post Office Box 1778, in Royal Oak, Michigan. The zip code 48068. Again, that's Bible Blessings is the publisher. Post Office Box 1778 in Royal Oak, Michigan. The zip code 48068. If you're online, go to www.BibleBlessings.net. It's an easy one, BibleBlessings.net. And the price of it was around $20. I'm not sure you can get this at you can probably get it at your Bible bookstore, or with this information, they can order it for you, I'm sure. Or you could probably go right to the publisher. Just go to www.BibleBlessings.net, or you can just write to Bible Blessings, Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan, 48068, and I think you can get a copy. He begins the chapter by saying the lack of awareness concerning Parthia's power and influence in the ancient world was briefly mentioned in the previous chapter. But in this chapter, the reader will learn the history of the Parthian Empire, an ancient superpower whose history has been forgotten and ignored in the modern world. A quote by the 19th century British historian George Rawlinson lamented the widespread lack of awareness about Parthia, opened the preceding chapter, and this chapter will begin with an expanded version of this quote from George Rawlinson. Listen to this. He said, "The picture of the world during the Roman period, put before students in histories of Rome today, was defective, not to say false, in its omission to recognize the real position of Parthia as a counterpoise to the power of Rome, a rival state, dividing with Rome the attention of mankind and the sovereignty of the known earth. Writers of Roman history have been too much in the habit of representing Rome as a universal monarchy, having no limits other than the civilized world. The truth seems to be that from first to last, there's always been in the world a second power, which in a true sense balanced Rome, acted as a counterpoise and a check, and this power for nearly three centuries between B.C. 64 and A.D. 225 was Parthia. In the hope of gradually vindicating to Parthia her true place in world history, the author has placed the Parthians alongside the Romans." That was George Rawlinson. Now, George Rawlinson is not the only historian to note that Parthia was a world empire equivalent to Rome. James Strong, the author of Strong's Concordance, a famous biblical resource book, co-authored with John McClintock, the McClintock and Strong Cyclopedia of Biblical, Theological, and Ecclesiastical Literature. That work was first published in the 19th century, where they wrote, quote, "Parthia was a power almost rivaling Rome. The only existing power which had tried its strength against Rome and had not been worsted in the encounter. In neglecting the history of the Parthian Empire, modern writers have committed a grievous omission and done a great disservice to modern students of history. To grasp the scale of this omission, let's consider this analogy. What if historians two millennia in the future wrote the history of the 20th century entirely from the standpoint of Russia, and then mentioned nothing about the United States, or mentioned the United States as merely a footnote to history of the 20th century? It would yield a grossly inaccurate perception of the 20th century, would it not? And yet, that is the scale of historical inaccuracy which has resulted from historians' focus only on Rome and scarcely mentioning the Parthian Empire. This chapter will reveal the true role of Parthia in world history. And even though much is known about Parthia, very little is known about the Parthian Empire, and it's very seldom taught in any modern history textbook. It's a mere footnote to Roman history. Rawlinson's books about Parthia are based on the histories of the Greco-Roman classical writers such as Justin, Dio, Cassius, Strabo, Plutarch, and others, who wrote extensively about Parthia. It's very odd indeed that although Roman writers deemed Parthia worthy of a great deal of attention, modern history texts virtually ignore this ancient world empire. And as we learned in the previous chapter, Parthia was an Asian empire dominated by the 10 tribes of Israel who had transplanted into the region of Asia, formerly ruled by Assyria and Medo-Persia. If the history of Parthia had been consistently taught to students, the myth that the 10 tribes of Israel were lost would never have existed. Rawlinson began his discussion of Parthia at a time when it was Rome's equal, about 64 BC. In fact, Parthia possessed a large empire long before 64 BC, but it had very little contact with Rome in its early period. Parthia's first great opponent was the Seleucid Greek Empire, which was their heir to most of the Asian conquests of Alexander the Great. The Parthians had become a province of the Seleucid Greek Empire after Alexander the Great destroyed the Persian Empire. Parthia was located southeast of the Caspian Sea and declared its independence from the Seleucid Greek Empire about 250 BC. To help modern readers put their action in perspective, the Parthian action was similar to that of the American colonies in 1776 who declared their independence from Great Britain, just as the American colonies had been ruled by a large and powerful British Empire, the Parthians had been ruled by a large and powerful Seleucid Greek Empire, and like the Americans, the Parthians had to fight for their independence before it became a reality. The first independent king of Parthia was known as Arsaces, and the history records that he came to Parthia from Scythia or Bactria. As discussed in the first chapter, the Bactrians were very likely the Bactites or Bactrites of the tribe of Ephraim that we see recorded in the book of Numbers, chapter 26, verse 35. They were related to the Scythian Saki tribe. Arsaces, therefore, came to Parthia from another region inhabited by the 10 tribes of Israel. Arsaces, whose name included the root word Isaac, began a dynasty that ruled Parthia throughout its history. And since Genesis 49, verse 10 promised that dynasties of kings would proceed from the tribe of Judah, it suggests that Arsaces was a member of the tribe of Judah. As Israelites, the Parthian people would understandably have been receptive to being ruled by a member of the royal dynasty which had previously led the Israelites to their greatest glory under Kings David and Solomon. And as the previous chapter also noted, the Davidic origin of Parthia's kings is indicated by the root word. Pheres, an ancestor of King David, in the names of Parthian kings, also since Jeremiah 33:17 promised that David's descendants would always serve on thrones over the 10 tribes of Israel. Arsaces was surely a descendant of King David. And as the first chapter noted, David's royal descendants were made vassal kings over parts of the Babylonian Empire, and his descendants had become numerous in Asia. Rawlinson comments that Parthian kings and the Parthian kingdom was thoroughly anti-Hellenic and revolted from the Hellenic Seleucids at a time when the Seleucids were involved with their own ongoing rivalry with the Egyptian Ptolemies. Consider the political situation at the time of Parthia's declaration of independence. After the death of Alexander the Great, his empire was divided into four separate kingdoms. The two strongest of the kingdoms, of which became the Seleucid Empire of Asia and the Ptolemaic Empire of Egypt, the four-way division of Alexander's empire was a fulfillment of Daniel's prophecy in Daniel 11, verses 1 through 4, about a mighty Grecian king who would supplant the Persian Empire, die in his prime, and then have his kingdom divided into four sections. According to Josephus, the Jewish high priest personally showed this prophecy in the book of Daniel to Alexander when he was in Jerusalem. Daniel's prophecy was given in the 6th century BC, and Alexander the Great fulfilled it in the 4th century BC. This is just one more example that there is a creator God who controls world events to ensure that Bible prophecy does come to pass. Now the Greek Seleucids and the Egyptian Ptolemies fought a series of wars making it possible for Parthia to revolt in approximately 250 BC. With the Seleucids weakened by war, the Parthians were emboldened to annex another Seleucid province. The Seleucid king then attacked and initially routed the upstart Parthians, causing Arsaces to flee to his Scythian kinsmen to seek refuge from the reinforcements throughout Parthia's history. These Parthian kings sought refuge or military support from the Saki Scythian tribes during times of crisis, underscoring their common heritage with the Saki. The Saki gave the Parthian king military assistance, as did the Bactrians, and in 237 BC, this alliance defeated the army of the Seleucid Empire in a critical battle which made the independence of the Parthians a reality. It was a historic turning point, and Rawlinson records that the Parthians long observed the anniversary of this battle as a solemn festival. Now, American readers can relate to the beginning of the Parthian nation. The traditional Parthian celebration of an Independence Day to commemorate their freedom from Seleucid rule is comparable to Americans celebrating their Independence Day on July 4th to commemorate their freedom from British rule. Also, just as the Parthians needed outside help from the Scythians to obtain their independence, America needed outside help from France in order to realize its independence. Now, there are a number of striking parallels between the Parthians of the ancient world and the Americans of the modern world. Since they do exist, these parallels will be noted periodically as we proceed along with our investigation of this Parthian empire. Parthia's rise to power coincided with the gradual waning of Carthage in the Second and Third Punic Wars. However, during the first few decades of Parthia's rivalry with the Seleucid Greeks, Rome was fighting for its survival as Hannibal's Carthaginian army invaded Italy and almost conquered Rome. Eventually, Rome gained the advantage, and while Carthage and Israelite power in the Mediterranean was in decline, Parthia and Israelite power in Asia was gradually rising to empire status. By the time Carthage fell, Parthia had already become an empire and was destined to become Rome's great enemy. When Arsaces died, he was replaced by his brother, Tiridates, who led the Parthians in their great victory over the Seleucids. He also built a fortress city named Dara, D-A-R-A. Dara is a Hebrew name that we see in 1 Chronicles 2, verse 6, and because Dara was the name of a patriarch of the tribe of Judah, the king, Tiridates, naming a city in honor of a Jewish patriarch, supports the conclusion that the Arsacid dynasty was from the tribe of Judah. Since the early Parthian city of Asak, A-S-A-A-K, named after Isaac, I-S-A-A-C, also bears a Hebrew name, the Israelite nature of the Parthian Empire was easily apparent from its inception. And it needs to be stressed, however, that although the ruling dynasty of the Parthians were descendants of Judah's King David, the Parthians themselves were descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel. This fulfilled the prophecy of Jeremiah 33, verse 17, that David's descendants would rule over the non-Jewish descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel, known as the House of Israel. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. You know, this income tax and Social Security programs are not compatible with our traditional American values, and that's because these two programs are the second and eighth planks of the Communist Manifesto. These two programs call for a heavy progressive income tax to place in place of tithing, and Social Security is a social welfare scheme that takes the place of strict liability and individual responsibility. The income tax requires of us that we serve two masters in violation of Matthew 6, verse 24, and the income tax requires of us that we rob God in violation of Malachi 3, verse 8. And the income tax requires that we commit idolatry in violation of Exodus 20, verse 3. And the income tax requires of us that we use unjust weights and balances. That's a violation of Leviticus 19, verses 35 and 36. And the income tax requires that we sign contracts or covenants with these foreign and alien gods called government in violation of Exodus 23, verses 32 and 33. Social Security violates the strict liability statute in Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36. And Social Security violates the 10th commandment by appealing to our lust and greed. And we're taught to call that income redistribution. The scripture calls it just what it is, covetousness and theft, in violation of Exodus 20, verse 17, and Exodus 20, verse 15. You know, the God of Israel gave us a better way of life than that, and our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention followed that better way of life, and that's why I contend that you and I ought to learn how to practice a better way than income tax and Social Security. Now, for more information about tax and status, why don't you call me here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. The number again, area code 417-273-4967. Now, that free general law CD package is a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, educational, it's informative, best of all, it's free of charge, and you can order yours right now on the Internet. Go to the webpage, georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about Parthia, the Forgotten Ancient Superpower, another blockbuster book written by Stephen Collins. Collins lives up in South Dakota. He's an eminent historian, member of the Epigraphic Society. He, like George Rawlinson, is into Bible prophecy. These unusual and unique prophecies and historical references of the 10 tribes of Israel, and indeed the ancient kingdoms and the histories of the ancient world, and how they impact upon us today, and how Bible prophecy is in the process of being fulfilled. You can get a copy of the book. It's Bible Blessings is the publisher. Bible Blessings, P.O. Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan. That's Bible Blessings, Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan. The zip code is 48068. That's 48068. Stephen Collins. Another war with the Seleucids occurred about three decades after Parthia's Declaration of Independence. And although the more powerful Seleucids temporarily captured Parthia's capital city, the war ended with a treaty calling for the Seleucids' withdrawal in about 206 BC, and Parthia remaining independent. This results in another striking parallel in the early history of the United States of America. Having won its freedom from Britain, America had to again fight the British in the War of 1812. And in that war, the British temporarily captured Washington, D.C., the American capital city, but the war ended with a peace treaty in which the British withdrew and the Americans maintained their independence. Just as America's War of 1812 was soon followed by a period of manifest destiny in which the young and vigorous American nation spread across North America, Parthia's second war with the Seleucids was followed by a period of great expansion, which extended Parthian rule over much of South Central Asia. Phraates I of Parthia took control of the Caspian Gates, the key mountain passes which controlled the east-west invasion routes across Persia. Parthia's possession of these strategic Caspian gates fulfilled another aspect of the Abrahamic covenant, which had been inherited by Isaac, passed on to Jacob, and then to the Israelite tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh. We read of that in Genesis chapter 48. Now, God had promised Abraham that his birthright seed would possess the gates of their enemies. We see that in Genesis 22, verse 17. Such gates are geographical choke points which control or limit access to military forces in wartime or key routes of commerce in peacetime. Now, the next Parthian monarch, Mithridates I, expanded Parthian power to true empire status. And Rawlinson describes Mithridates, the brother of Phraates I, as follows. He said, "One of those rare individuals to whom it has been given to unite the powers which form and from the conqueror with whose and those which constitute the successful organizer of a state, brave and enterprising in war, yet mild, clement, philanthropic. He conciliated those whom he had subdued almost more easily than he subdued them, and by the efforts of a few years succeeded in welding together a dominion which lasted without suffering serious mutilation for nearly 400 years. Now, by the time of his death, Mithridates I had placed Bactria, Media, Babylonia, Persia, and several other regions under Parthian domination, dominion, and rule from the Hindu Kush to the Euphrates River, a distance of 1,500 miles from east to west. And on modern maps, the dominion of Mithridates I is roughly equivalent to the territory from northern Syria and eastern Turkey to western Pakistan and from modern Uzbekistan to the Persian Gulf. The Euphrates River, as nearly as the 2nd century BC, became the traditional western border of Parthia. Most of Parthia's expansion came at the expense of the Seleucid Greeks, whose empire and whose emperor he defeated and captured. Mithridates I died in 136 BC, leaving a large empire in the hands of his son, Phraates II, although Mithridates I of Parthia was one of the ancient world's greatest conquerors and builders. He built one of the ancient world's largest and most powerful empires, and it would be difficult to find a modern history textbook today that even mentions his name. In 129 BC, the Seleucids attacked the new Parthian Empire with an army numbering about 300,000, while the Parthian army numbered only 120,000. Scythian troops reinforced the Parthians, but arrived too late to be decisive in the battles that followed. However, this willingness on the part of Scythia to aid Parthia in its wars was an oft-repeated pattern in Parthian history. The western provinces of the Parthians revolted to the side of their old rulers, the Seleucids. Three battles were fought in which the outnumbered Parthians were defeated each time. The Parthians exhibited a dogged determination, however, and refused to capitulate even though the war, so far, favored their enemies. Winter set in, and the Seleucid army conducted itself so oppressively in the occupied provinces that their people privately sent word to the Parthians that they would again welcome Parthian rule if Parthia would liberate them from the oppressive Seleucids. Now, even though the Seleucids were now in grave danger, they spurned a merciful offer of peace from Phraates with unacceptable demands of their own. The people of the captive provinces attacked the unsuspecting Seleucid troops within their garrison towns, and the Parthian regulars crushed the Seleucid monarch and his remaining troops in a final battle. Historians record that the Seleucid monarch Antiochus perished along with his army of 300,000. This battle was another historic turning point in world history because it broke the back of the Seleucid Empire, which withered away to nothing, trapped between the two growing powers of Rome on the west and Parthia on the east. One result of Parthia's historic victory was that the Maccabees of Judea were able to assert their independence from the now mortally wounded Seleucids, and Rawlinson comments on this fact in the following words. Quote, "The immediate result of the destruction of Antiochus and his host was the revolt of Judea." Now, the Jews even conquered the Edomites, who submitted to circumcision and Jewish laws. Josephus records that these Edomites merged with the Jews and they became one people, the Edomite Jews. However, Judea, the house of Judah, was able to assert its independence from the Seleucids only because Parthia, part of the 10 tribes of Israel, had crushed the Seleucids. The Parthians treated the conquered Seleucids mercifully and their royal households intermarried. Herein lies another parallel between Parthia and modern America. Even as America has been a merciful conqueror, building up Japan and Germany after World War II, for instance, rescuing the German capital from a Russian blockade in the Berlin airlift, and many other honorable deeds, Parthia was also a merciful ruler of the people that it defeated in war. And it's a clear commentary on the enlightened character of Parthian rule that the people in the contested provinces, after tasting both Parthian and Seleucid rule, actively fought the Seleucids in order to become Parthian subjects once again. Now, at this juncture, Phraates II and the Parthians should have enjoyed their time of great triumph. However, a bizarre event occurred. Earlier it was noted that the Scythian army, allied to the Parthians, arrived too late to assist in this final battle of the war. Well, the Scythians arrived just after Parthia had crushed the Seleucid army, and a battle between the Scythians and the Parthians erupted when the Parthians refused to share any war booty with the Scythians. Now, the Scythians likely suspected that the Parthians had jumped the gun on the war in order to deprive the Scythians of their share of the expected booty. The Parthians felt that since the Scythians did not participate in the fighting, that they should not be paid. At any rate, Phraates II reneged on his promised payment to the Scythians, who had, after all, left their lands and families and marched hundreds of miles to hazard their lives at Parthia's request. Well, in this bizarre battle between related tribesmen, similar to the North and South in the Civil War, the Scythian army was victorious, and the Parthian king died in the battle just after crushing the Seleucid Empire. The Parthians were themselves defeated by their Scythian allies who had marched out of the north to help Parthia. At that point in history, Scythia was still more powerful than Parthia. However, as one would expect between a battle of brothers, the victorious northern Scythians had no interest in annexing Parthia to their own tribal homelands. So while the Parthians were motivated to conquer and hold an empire composed of different nations, the isolationist Scythians had no interest in taking advantage of this obvious opportunity for territorial gain. Now, this whole event is uncannily similar to a battle described in the Bible in Judges chapters 11 and 12. After winning a great victory over the Ammonites, Japheth and an army of Gileadites, the tribe of Manasseh, Reuben, and Gad, were confronted by an army of Ephraimites, which was upset that it had not participated in the battle and missed out on the booty. The usually allied brother tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh then fought each other in a needless battle over war booty. The tribe of Manasseh defeated the Ephraimites in a battle costing 42,000 Ephraimites their lives. The dominance of the tribe of Ephraim in the Parthian Empire and the dominance of Manasseh in the Scythian Empire has been discussed earlier, making this Parthian-Scythian battle a return of the war in Judges chapter 12. And though Ephraim and Manasseh are brother tribes, just like Great Britain and the United States, even they can fight one another. Historically, whenever this birthright or the birthright tribes of Ephraim and Manasseh came to blows, Manasseh usually won the war, just like America won the war against Great Britain. After the warfare, the Scythians, satisfied by their possession of war booty and the death of the Parthian king who cheated them, they returned to their own land. And this confirms that the Scythians had no territorial designs against their Parthian kinsmen and were content simply to teach the Parthians a lesson. That lesson was learned, as there is no record that the Parthians ever again reneged when the Scythians came to help them in a war. Nevertheless, Parthia had now replaced the Seleucids as the dominant power in southern Asia, and it was only a matter of time before Rome and Parthia came in contact with one another. So before we discuss this epic struggle between Parthia and Rome, we will examine the governmental structure and policies of the Parthians to see what it was that made their dominion so preferable to that of the Seleucid Greeks. Parthia's feudalism, magi, and moderate rule worked like this. Although Parthia was ruled by a single dynasty, there was no custom of succession to the throne, such as we see today in Great Britain, where the firstborn son takes the throne, whereby the oldest son of the previous king automatically inherits the kingdom. Well, any male relative of the king could serve as the new monarch. The Parthians had a system of checks and balances upon the authority of the king, which predated the Magna Carta by more than 1,000 years. Strabo, the Greco-Roman who lived just prior to the time of Christ, wrote, quote, that the council of the Parthians consists of two groups, one that of the kinsmen and the other that of the wise men and the magi, or the magi, from both of which groups the kings were appointed. Rawlinson refers to these two bodies as the royal house and the senate, similar to what we have today, the House of Representatives and the Senate, or the House of Lords and the Senate in Great Britain. The royal house contained the male members of the royal line, and the senate consisted of the wise men, prominent secular leaders, and the magi, the priestly caste. He observed that these two houses jointly constituted the magistanes, the nobles, and the privileged class, which, to a considerable extent, checked and controlled the monarchy. And he also noted that the king was permanently advised by these two councils. The monarchy was elective, but only in the house of Arsacidae, that's A-R-S-A-C-I-D-A-E, Arsacidae, or Arsacidae, and the concurrent vote of both councils was necessary in the appointment of a new king. In America, we appoint our new kings through an election. We call them presidents today. This means that while kings were elected by a concurrent vote of the two houses, all new kings had to be members of the royal house. The fact that the Parthians elected their kings by way of a bicameral vote may be one of the best-kept secrets of the ancient world. While only the members of the two houses of the magistanes voted in royal elections, there are a few examples of an elective process being involved in the selection of ancient monarchs. Now, the fact that the magistanes were standing deliberative bodies also acted as a further check upon the power of Parthian kings, even though Parthian monarchs could exercise autocratic powers once elected. And the existence of this bicameral council provided some restraint upon them. Kings could even be recalled if they sufficiently offended Parthia's nobility and priests. We call that, in this country, Bill Clinton went through an impeachment process. And it should be noted here that all American presidents, from George Washington to George Bush II, are descendants of Judah. They're all descendants of the royal family, the Windsors, descended from Charlemagne. And they're a part and parcel of the royal nobility of Europe. Parthia's governmental structure manifested the beginnings of a parliament and foreshadowed the Magna Carta of medieval England, which enabled the nobility to limit the power of English kings. The Magi, subject of Christmas stories as the givers of gold, frankincense, and myrrh to Jesus, were a very influential part of Parthian society, and some of them served as members of Parthia's Senate. Rawlinson states that the Magi were a powerful body consisting of an organized hierarchy which had come down from ancient times and was feared and venerated by all classes of people. Their numbers at the close of the empire, counting males only, are reckoned at about 80,000. They were the sole inhabitants of many large towns or villages which they were permitted to govern as they pleased. You'll see that that's the system that Moses set up in ancient Israel, where the Levites had their own cities or their own suburbs, and they governed them themselves. Today we call this the judicial system, or a system like the Levitical priests of ancient times, which we today call the civil service here in the United States. All right, you're listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Tonight's report is on Parthia, the forgotten ancient superpower. You know, when you're making $50,000 a year, you pay about $7,650 in Social Security taxes. In addition to that, you pay a 17% income tax on that same $50,000. Now, that's another $8,500. That means you just paid an extra $1,300 by paying your tax on a tax. and that makes the real effective Social Security tax rate 17.8%. That's not the 15.3% that's been advertised. Now, isn't that just real special? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call me here at the law school? The number's 417-273-4967. Remember, that's 417-273-4967. Help take a bite out of crime. Call and ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. That's a 4-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can order yours online. Just go to georgegordon.org, click onto the email machine, and send me an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. Tonight's report, Parthia, the Forgotten Ancient Superpower, written by Stephen Collins. You can order a copy from Bible Blessings, Post Office Box 1778, Royal Oak, Michigan. The zip code 48068. It's about $20. To get particulars, why don't you go to the website first? It's www.BibleBlessings.net. It's an easy one to remember. www.BibleBlessings.net. The Magi, or Magi, paralleled the Levites of ancient Israel. The tribe of Levi had been the priestly tribe of the Israelites, and the law of Moses, as we see in Numbers 35, verses 1 through 8, required that the Levites dwell in their own independent cities. Today in America, we call this the federal judiciary. The federal judiciary is the Aaronic priesthood, and the Levitical priesthood today is represented by our state courts. We have an upper caste and a lower caste of civil service in our priesthood. In Joshua chapter 21, it records that the priestly Levites were given 48 independent cities to inhabit in the territory of ancient Palestine. The Parthians emulated the Israelite tradition of having independent cities for its priestly class. That the Parthian Magi were a hierarchy of priests that had descended from ancient times, it indicates that the Magi were an inherently hereditary body, an actual tribe of priests. Since the Israelite nature of the Parthians was or has already been shown, the Parthian Magi were likely a body of Levites, Israel's hereditary tribe of priests. A priest of the Parthian Magi is depicted on a bas relief bearing a conical hat, reminiscent of the mitre worn by the Israelite priests and the tall caps of the Scythian leaders. Now, while the image of Rome's legions brutally enforcing obedience in Rome's conquered provinces is a common theme in history, what was Parthia's rule like? Well, Parthia's king was the overall monarch of Parthia's empire, but provincial vassal kings and rulers were given considerable autonomy within the overall guidelines set by the Parthian king. Concerning the vassal kings, similar to our governors today over our 50 states, Rawlinson stated, "So long as they paid their tribute regularly to the Parthian monarchs and aided them in their wars, they were allowed to govern the people beneath their sway at their own pleasure." Now, while the Parthian kings retained sovereignty concerning such matters as taxes and national defense, Parthian provinces were largely self-governing regarding local matters. Parthia's system of vassal kings and subordinate nobles were subject to an overall king will remind some readers of the feudal system utilized by the Europeans in the Middle Ages. Edward Gibbon, the prominent historian who authored the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, also noted the parallels between the feudal systems of the Parthians and medieval Europe. Gibbon's observation about the similarity between the Parthian and European feudal systems is quoted by Rawlinson, to wit. He said, "The remark has been made by Gibbon that the Parthian system exhibited under the names a lively image of the feudal system, which has since prevailed in Europe. The points of difference between the Parthian and the European feudal systems has been probably more numerous than those of the resemblance. But the points of resemblance being very main points, not few in number, and very striking. So it's noteworthy that while the known parallels between the Parthian and European feudal systems are very main points and striking, their differences were only assumed to exist, as one can see, by the use of the word probably in the above quote. It is as if Rawlinson could scarcely believe that the Parthian Empire in Asia represented such a remarkable forerunner of the society of medieval Europe. The Encyclopedia Britannica also commented on the feudal nature of Parthia's empire. The Encyclopedia says this, quote, "These nomads, the Scythians and Parthians, were the main pillar of the empire, and from them were obviously derived the great magnates, with their huge estates and hosts of serfs who composed the imperial council. They led the armies, governed the provinces, and made the and unmade the kings." And as will be documented in the fourth book in the series on Israelite history, the striking similarities between the Parthians and medieval Europe was no coincidence. It is also recorded that the Parthians pioneered the concept of municipal home rule privileges for some of its cities. For example, the Greek towns in large numbers throughout the Parthian Empire enjoyed a municipal government of their own, and in some cases were almost independent communities. Seleucia, its population, was estimated in the first century after Christ at 600,000, had its own municipal council elected by the people to rule them. This astounding fact that Parthia's empire included large home-ruled cities that held municipal elections to elect city councils should be taught in every classroom in the modern Western world. Cities in the modern Western world have for centuries copied this ancient Parthian practice, and it's remarkable that an ancient empire allowed its citizens such freedoms. Most ancient empires, fearing dissent and revolts, ruled their subject peoples with an iron hand. Josephus records a curious trait of the Parthians, which provides another uncanny parallel with modern America, and will readily understand or be understood by Americans today. Josephus recorded that it was a Parthian custom to seal an agreement by shaking hands. Josephus wrote, "This is of the greatest force there with all of these, the Parthians, for none of them will deceive you when once they have given you their right hands, nor will any one doubt their fidelity when it is once given. The joining of the right hands was esteemed among the Persians and Parthians, in particular, a most inviolable obligation of fidelity." When Parthians shook hands on a deal, it meant that their entire honor was at stake in keeping whatever had been the subject of the agreement. This Parthian custom continues today among modern Americans who have a long history, that one's honor is at stake when they shake hands on a deal. To renege on a deal after you had shaken hands over it meant that one's reputation would be permanently damaged. There was also a substantial Jewish population in Parthia's empire. When the Jews were carried captive by the Assyrians and Babylonians into Asia, most never returned to Palestine, and only a small remnant of Jews returned to rebuild Jerusalem during the rule of the Medo-Persian Empire, as described in the biblical books of Ezra and Nehemiah. Those returnees gave birth to the Jews who populated Judea during the time of Christ. However, far more Jews remained in Asia than the smaller number that had returned to Judea. And the book of Esther records that the Jews were numerous and present in the provinces of the Persian Empire, from India to Ethiopia. Now, the Asian Jews in the Persian Empire eventually became subjects of the Parthian Empire. The policy of the Parthians toward the Jews was very magnanimous. Rawlinson records that, quote, there were also a certain number of places that the inhabitants of which were wholly Jews, and these enjoyed similar privileges with the free towns of the Greeks. Parthia's large Jewish population merits additional comment. Josephus wrote that the descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel were very numerous, not subject to Rome, and were located beyond the Euphrates River. By referencing the Euphrates River, the border between the Roman and Parthian empires, Josephus was indicating that Parthia was Israelite territory. And since Josephus knew about the Israelite nature of the Parthians and the sacking, many other Jews surely knew about it as well. Some Jews, tired of Rome's yoke in Palestine, may have emigrated to Parthia, which was dominated by the descendants of the 10 tribes of Israel and allowed much personal liberty. However, the main reason for a substantial Jewish population in Asia is that most exiled Jews never did return to Palestine from their Babylonian captivity, and their descendants stayed in Asia, flourishing under Parthian rule. Now, while Rome imposed a rule of iron within its empire, Parthia permitted greater individual freedoms, and this fact has strong parallels in the modern world, a discussion of which will enable the reader to relate to the struggles between Rome and Parthia. Parthia and Rome were the two superpowers of their day. Parthia had the beginnings of a bicameral body with some checks and balances upon the power of the monarchy, and it gave provinces and cities considerable local autonomy while maintaining federal control of foreign and military matters. Parthia was tolerant toward its subject people and allowed Greek and Jewish cities broad local freedoms. And Rome, however, ruled its subject nations in a totalitarian, oppressive manner, with Roman troops supporting Rome's tight controls over conquered nations. In any comparison between the ancient superpowers of Rome and Parthia and the modern superpowers of the United States of America and the former Soviet Union, Parthia's freedoms would compare to that of the United States, while Rome's oppressiveness would make it an ancient counterpart of the Soviet Union. In one sense, this is too strong an assertion, for the Romans were a very religious people, worshipping many gods, unlike the godless atheism of the former Soviet Union. Yet the point to be made is that the whole Western world is force-fed almost exclusively this bogus history of Rome, while Parthia's remarkable history is totally ignored. And while this parallel may seem revolutionary to some, it's necessary to help us understand and to undo the widespread myth that Rome was civilized while all the rest of the world was barbarian. In reality, it was just exactly the opposite. In the remainder of this chapter and in our fourth book in this series on Israelite history, we will see that the social institutions of medieval and modern Europe developed from the Parthian system, not from the Roman system. Now let's take a look at the Eastern Scythians who merged with Parthia. There is one important event in Parthian history that must be discussed before we examine its long historic rivalry with Rome. After the Seleucid Empire had been defeated and absorbed by the Parthian Empire, the eastern part of Parthia's empire was invaded by a large number of Scythian or Sacchi. In fact, this invasion gave the Parthians a major infusion of related Sacchi or Scythian kinsmen to bolster their empire. These Sacchi entered the eastern portion of Parthia's empire in the 1st century BC after migrating southward from the Caspian Sea region. Besides bearing the name of Isaac, these Scythian tribes had tribal names that can be linked to the names of various Israelite tribes today. The principal Scythian tribe which migrated into the Parthian Empire was called the Massagetae, M-A-S-S-A-G-E-T-A-E, Massagetae. the same Scythian tribe which crushed an invading Persian army under King Cyrus the Great, as discussed in the final chapter of the previous book in the series. The Massagetae were accompanied by allied tribes, the Dahi and the Takari, the Asi, the Sakurli, and other clans such as the Parni, Aparni, Clarosmi, and George Rawlinson opined that this invasion was a barbaric peril from Asia. However, the facts do not support such a view. For example, the Parni and the Aparni are frequently cited as being the original tribes of Arsaces, the first Parthian king, and another Scythian tribe. The Dahi aided the Parthians in various wars. These invaders were actually the Parthians' own Scythian kinsmen. And history records that after some fighting over territories, the Scythian tribes became part of the Parthian Empire, with their new homeland being named Sakastane, that is S-A-C-A-S-T-A-N-E, Sakastane, land of the Saki or Scyths. The Scythians, who named their new territory in honor of Isaac, the Israelite patriarch, had a common racial and cultural heritage with the Parthians. In one of his maps, Rawlinson shows Sakastana in the eastern part of the Parthian Empire. The fact that Israelite tribes would fight among themselves is not surprising, given that they had to jostle one another to find territory to contain their large populations. Rawlinson proposed in his book that these migrating Scythians were themselves pushed into Parthia by the Huns of Central Asia. You'll note here the parallels that Rawlinson and Stephen Collins put together in describing the histories of the United States and Great Britain as being parallel or similar to that of the Scythians and the Parthians. Well, we're going to have to take a break right there. We'll be back tomorrow night with more on the forgotten ancient superpower, that is Parthia. You've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the Gordon Law School and The Law Hour, please go to my webpage. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on my webpage. That's georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly, and it has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through my website at georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Remember to order yours. Just go to the law school telephone number. It's 417-273-4967. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week on Truth Radio Network and worldwide on the Internet. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, nonprofit, non-commercial, non-sectarian law school, and all of these Law Hour programs are carried worldwide on the Internet. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events 7 days a week. All right, there's the signal. It says my time is up. I got to leave it right there. I'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. So until then, good night, friends.